value or the kindness of the tree. So this is correct. The trees themselves, in that sense, they're not volunteering their services in this material world. But the body of a tree, it's meant for service. So if someone is occupying the body of a tree, that body is meant for service. And the trees of Vrindavan are alive and awake in their offerings of service. And so the trees bow down when Krishna comes by, and they offer their flowers, they sprinkle their flowers in front of him as he's coming near to their presence. And they cry when they see him walking by, because they realize that he will keep walking on and we are stationary. We have to stay here. So they're thinking, oh, Krishna's now walking into the forest and we will be missing him. And in Vrindavan in the morning, when Krishna leaves Nandagram, where he resides, and comes into the forest comes alive immediately. Because in Vrindavan, these trees, these are not ordinary trees, but these trees are full and alive and conscious in their devotion to Krishna. So Krishna appreciated them, and he told the boys, and he praised them, that somebody should live by the example of trees, to give and sacrifice their life for the well-being of others. And we heard that Krishna said also, human beings who act for the benefit of others are called devotees. Those who act for their own personal benefit only, they are just pretending to be saintly or virtuous. So here we hear all about the trees. And then Krishna told the boys, when they started to say, we're very hungry, and they were thinking, if we're hungry, Krishna must be hungry. And so we must get Krishna something, and if we say that, Krishna, you must be hungry, he may say, no, it's okay. So we will say, we're hungry, and they were hungry, but they were thinking how to get something for Krishna to eat. So then Krishna told them that there were some very high-minded, pious brahmanas who lived nearby. They lived just outside of the town known as Surasenapur. Their ashrams are there. And these brahmanas were very, very well known because they had learnt the art of chanting mantras in a particular way. They had all the right intonations when they chanted, and they were very regulated. So they had all the right behavior, they did everything so nicely, neatly, cleanly, and regulatedly, that they had become very popular. And people really appreciated them. So you see, in Indian culture, what you do is, if you have a problem of some sort, you do a yajna, right? Yes. Everyone knows this. You do a yajna, you go to the temple and you say, oh, my uncle is sick, so please can you do some worship and puja, and then my uncle will get better. So these brahmanas were very good at this, and they had become popular with the local people and also well-to-do. So Krishna, he glorified the brahmanas to the boys, and then he told them that you go there and for sure these brahmanas will give you what you need. He said, brahmanas, even if they have austerity of knowledge and so forth, but they do not act for the satisfaction, for any satisfaction, or for others' satisfaction, or they are devoid of devotion, then they are not actually truly brahmanas. But these brahmanas are very good. So you go and you say, when you go there, you tell them, Krishna and Balaram are just nearby, not far away. And on Balaram's request, please, if you can give us some food because we're hungry. So the boys were very happy to do this. And they left immediately for the yajnashala. And when they got there, they could, first of all, they smelt they could smell the burning ghee. And as everyone here knows, especially if you live in the Prabhupada house for some time, when you smell the burning ghee, it's a very wonderful fragrance. And it sometimes makes you feel like, it must be nearly time for prasadam. It's a very good taste. So they could smell the ghee. And that made them feel like, very soon we're going to get something to eat. And they could see the streams of smoke coming up in the air, like curling like incense up into the air. And they heard all the mantras being chanted perfectly, exactly in the right meter, exactly with the right accent. They could hear this as they were coming, and this was satisfying to the ears. And also as they came closer, they saw the white houses of the brahmanas. And these yagyas were being done on the eastern side of their houses. And they had many pavilions set up with flowers and flags and so forth, and the sacrificial fires all lit, created in the middle and burning, just like we see here when there's a wedding or a special occasion. This was all there, and this was very nice. And they were thinking, yes, and soon we're going to be fed. Done. And so they saw the priests were coming from their houses and coming here, and they were chanting many mantras. Is there another system?
That's the actual one, but it was used for the program last night.
Okay. All right, let's use it here. And they saw all of this and they thought to themselves, this is going to be so exciting, so nice people, and we're going to get everything taken care of very quickly. So they went up to the brahmanas, who were all sitting there chanting their mantras and turning the key into the fire and chanting their mantras and again the key. And they looked around and they saw big piles of wood, because they were putting the wood, and there were people coming and putting wood on the fires. The fires were really, really blazing. They saw kusha grass on the side. They saw golden pots on the side of each of the yogis, and they were full of water or clarified butter and so many things. And they stood there looking at everything, and they were really in awe. And they looked at the brahmanas, and the brahmanas continued on. And the brahmanas, out of the corner of their eyes, they saw the boys. And they sort of, sometimes you know how you would do this, you look at somebody and you look at what they're wearing. And you classify them very quickly. If they're kind of, you look at their shoes, and if their shoes are worn down, or their shoelaces are open, or they have odd socks on, you know, or their hat's on back to front, you think, oh, this is a bit unusual. And you may sort of choose to keep your attention on what you're doing and not really bother. So that's what the brahmanas did. They looked out of the corner of their eyes and they noticed that this is just little cowherd boys from a village. So we shouldn't stop our very important ceremonial, devotional activities for these little boys.
They were dirty.
They were a little dirty. Because they wrestle, you know, they have dirt on their arms, and they looked a little bit ordinary. Now, these brahmanas were performing what was known as the Angiras Yagya, and this was for elevation to the heavenly planets. So they were chanting, had to chant all the mantras properly. If you chant the mantras improperly, you get the wrong result. So chanting very perfectly, everything, and the boys were standing there, they're looking at them. The brahmanas were not looking at the boys, and they stood there a little bit longer, and they started to think, they seem to be ignoring us. But they were little and they were very confident because they were Krishna's friends. So they stood there for a little while and looked at the boys, looked at the brahmanas, and then they thought, we should make our request. So without being shy, they all bowed down, of course, first to the brahmanas, and after they had bowed down to the brahmanas, they said to them, we have come, please listen to us, we have come from Krishna and Balaram. They're near here. Balaram sent us, and we have come because Krishna and Balaram are very hungry. foreigners didn't pay any attention to them. And they said, you have great knowledge, so therefore, of course, you know who Krishna and Balaram are. You are like great demigods in your beauty and your fame and your knowledge. But Krishna and Balaram are the supreme lords themselves, and they're hungry. The Brahmanas didn't say anything. So the boys looked a little further, and they thought to themselves, these Brahmanas, they think that we're foolish, that we're just little boys and we don't know anything. So they looked at each other from the corner of their eyes to think what to do next, to say, and then they said, perhaps you're thinking that since you're initiated into the sacrifice, you cannot give us anything because the sacrifice is going on. It's just like here in the temple if you're doing the sacrifice and some little child comes up and says, can I have that banana? And you look around, where is her mother? And they whisk her away very quickly. So the boys were thinking, perhaps, you know, you're thinking that we don't know anything, because they saw in the middle of all these yogis, they were all around, so many, not one, so many, and so many mantras being chanted, and right in the middle they saw there was a platform, and on that platform were all these gold pots with all the food that was being offered in the yogi. So the boys had noted where they were in the process of offering the mantras, because they knew everything, because they knew Krishna. So they said to the Brahmanas, very politely, they said, we understand that when in the offering of yajnas, it is not improper to offer the food at particular times, even if the yajna is still going on. So you can actually offer the food to us at this particular time. Before you say the such and such a mantra, you can offer us the food now. They looked at the Brahmanas, and the Brahmanas didn't say anything. And then the boy said, you see, we see you as like our fathers. We're far away from home, and we had nothing to eat today, and we've been playing all day, and we're very, very tired. And you, we know, just like our father, when you see small children who are hungry, you will please give us something to eat. They didn't say anything. And the boys thought to themselves, perhaps they're not saying anything because they want us to go away. Perhaps because we're disturbing the yajna, they want us to go away. And then they thought that perhaps there was another reason why they did not answer. They thought, perhaps they're not in the habit of satisfying young children. Or perhaps, they were thinking in their minds, perhaps their hearts are very hard because they sacrifice animals. Then they thought, perhaps they're foolish. And they're very insincere. Getting a little more angry. And then they thought, perhaps they have never received the mercy of Krishna. So they stood there. That's what the boys were thinking. And our acharyas tell us what the Brahmanas were thinking. The Brahmanas were thinking, these boys are so arrogant. They're obviously just nearby boys from the forest, from the village, and they're telling us what to do. They're telling us the rules of giving an yajna. This must be the beginning of Kali Yuga. And they thought to themselves, they look a little wealthy. They don't look very, very poor. But they've come here not to give to us, because we are Brahmanas, so you should give to us. And they have come here not to give to us, but they've come to take from us. This was not good. And then they thought, we won't say yes, because the Brahmanas, like ourselves, should eat first. And then the other castes can eat. And we won't say no, because if there's anything left, we will give something to them. And then they said to themselves and to each other with their eyes, they said, some people say that Krishna and Balaram are the supreme lords themselves. But if they're the supreme lords, how could they be hungry or have any other needs? So thinking like this, the Brahmanas just continued with their rituals, continued with their devotion to their practices, continued with their worship, their mantra chanting, everything, their disciplines, they continued everything. But they ignored Krishna and Balaram's request. So the boys looked at each other and their faces became kind of pale. And then they thought, these Brahmanas are embarrassing us because there was nothing happening. And they became more and more uncomfortable. And their faces became very sad. When you see little boys with very sad faces, normally one goes, what's wrong? But the Brahmanas didn't. And the boys' faces looked very, very unhappy. And then because nothing was happening, they slowly turned away from the Brahmanas. And in a very unhappy way, they started walking back to Krishna. And you can imagine, their heads were down. They were mentally disturbed. They didn't really want to talk even to each other very much because they were so disappointed in these Brahmanas. And when they returned back to Krishna and Balaram, they came very, very slowly back. And from a distance, Krishna could see that they were looking very sad. And he was smiling. And the boys were coming along. And they said to Krishna, when they got there, our thoughts and our hearts and everything have become scattered by the harsh wind of these Brahmanas' response to us. And Krishna was smiling. And then the boys, you see, because Krishna had told them that these Brahmanas were very nice. So the boys, they didn't talk as much to Krishna. They began to talk instead to Balaram. They were so mentally disturbed and they said to Balaram, oh Rama, we have never seen such harshness as we saw in the eyes of those Brahmanas. I think those Brahmanas are Brahmanas in name only. They're first-class fools. They do not understand the Vedas. We begged for food, and they did not even answer us. And at least the minimum response from a Brahmana who's knowing the Vedas and all the spiritual paths and everything, the minimum response is they should have responded to us. They didn't even do that. In their homes, we heard so many things going on. We saw them. They were going here and there and there and here. They were saying, pass me this and give me this. They were talking to everybody else. They were saying, let us have a drink, let us eat. They were saying so many things. So many things were going on. And we saw some of them were even eating in their houses. And outside, there were thousands of people. So many people were there. It was so busy. And we were so angry, we just didn't go near those people. We just turned around and walked away and came back here. They said, they dishonored generosity. They were so mean. By going there, and now they were looking at Krishna, they said, by going there, we were only humiliated. And so we left. And all they knew was that they enhanced their prestige by doing all these yajnas. But they didn't give us anything for you. Krishna, we brought back nothing except the smoke we inhaled in our noses while we were there. We hold your instructions on our head like Vedic injunctions. But it is just like if nectar becomes salty or salt becomes sweet. That's very confusing. So how is it that your words put us in such an embarrassing situation? Now here is a very interesting circumstance, because sometimes we feel like Krishna does this to us. He puts us in a situation, or maybe we say our authorities put us in a situation. They tell us to do something, and we follow wholeheartedly and try and do it, and it seems that it doesn't work, it goes wrong. And so we feel like, oh, this is not good. How can we trust? So here we hear the boys are speaking like this, but the boys are very simple, and they can talk to Krishna like this, but it never, never, never weakens their trust. They never get doubtful moments, doubtful days, worried like that. They're thoroughly and wholly, because they're in the spiritual world, they're wholly, not H-O-L-Y, but H-W-H-O-L-E, wholly serving to Krishna, loving to Krishna. There's no space for themselves. We think, oh, that sounds awful. That sounds like my personality would be extinguished. But no, their personality comes alive in relationship to Krishna. Just like when you're sleeping, we all have this experience. When you're sleeping, your hand is like dead. Your hand is sleeping. Your finger can't stand up and do anything by itself because your finger is dependent on your consciousness. And as soon as you're awake, your hand is awake. So we are to Krishna like the hand is to the body. We are part and parcel of Krishna. And when we become actually lifeless, when we feel ourselves separate from Krishna, when in our consciousness, we're thinking ourselves a separate, independent person other than under the care or service of the deities. And for us as conditioned souls, that's our normal state. And when we go outside, we find people who are feeling great satisfaction and making great money and so on and so forth by being totally separate and independent from Krishna. And so for a young devotee, a new devotee, it's a bit confusing because they seem to be doing great. And I'm struggling away here trying to keep my eye fixed and it's so hard. And it seems like it would be like that forever. And so to hear that they have no separate independence from Krishna, it sounds monotonous. But then we have to remind the doubting mind of who Krishna is. You see, we have to become like teachers of ourselves. The first person we have to teach is ourself. And if you teach yourself, it's easy to teach other people because you understand their problems because you know your own problems. When I was in Hong Kong, we were speaking about this, and I spoke to the devotees about something that I found very relevant, and that was the difference between active and passive Krishna consciousness. And I used the example of smoking, that you can sit in a room full of smoking people and you're actually smoking, passively smoking. The smoke is going into your lungs too. And the smoke is being inhaled by you and exhaled by you, unbeknown to you. You're not choosing to smoke, but you're passively smoking because you're there. And I explained to them how we can come to Bhagavatam class even and be a passive hearer. It means everybody's sitting there, I'm sitting there too, we're all sitting there together, and my mind is wandering. My mind is going over things from yesterday, today, this thing, that thing. And I'm not attentive to what my mind is doing. I'm not having a relationship to where my mind is going. I'm not actively bringing my mind back and saying, pay attention now. Like, if you see a child, a bit of a restless, naughty child, you watch the mother, she's pulling the child from here, and the child crawls over her back, and she brings the child around the front. The child's over this side now, playing with someone, she gently, and a very good mother does all of that very effortlessly. So it doesn't even look like she's disturbed. So as we become very good devotees, we bring the mind back in an effortless way. But some people can go on for many, many, many years passively hearing. And so I was warning them that if you become a mechanical devotee, like these brahmanas, mechanically they're doing this, they're doing that, you can become quite expert because you're practicing every day, practicing, practicing. But the seed, the life of bhakti comes when you're an active hearer. And we did a little test. I told them, I put my hand up and I asked them all to look at my hand. They were all looking very carefully at my hand. And then I told them, now fix your gaze halfway between my hand and yourself. Like, change the way you're looking at it. Don't look at my hand. Look at this there, and my hand is here. And do you see, if you can do this, how my hand becomes fuzzy? Yeah? It immediately becomes fuzzy. It's out of focus. Because now my focus is somewhere between me and the object. It's somewhere in there. And so most of the time, most people, they don't even notice it because it's so normal. It's not normal, but it's so normal. They're not looking at anything. You look, next time you're on a tram or something, they have eyes, but they're not looking at anything. They're not focusing their eyes on anything. They're focused like this. And I said to them, I was teasing them, I said, you know, I sit here and I look at all of you. I can see who's going. I can see. So then they all sit up straight and they try a little bit harder to pay attention, because we want to pay attention, because we want to learn to become an active participant in our relationship with Krishna. We don't want to become a lifeless devotee. We want to become a full of life devotee. We don't want to be distracted by the problems of life, because we'll all have problems of life. And it's so easy to be distracted by them. You just let go a little bit and your mind will go racing around through the garden of all your problems and come back to you with a whole list of new ideas and what you can do to solve them. But in the meantime, for that block of time, whether it's a minute, whether it's an hour, you didn't think about Krishna. Or another thing that these brahmanas were doing, they may have thought about Krishna. There's a kind of a person in this world who is very devotional. But their devotion is, please help me with this. Please help me with that. Please fix up my marriage. Please get my children through college. Please get my daughter married. Please make this happen, make that happen, move this, do that. And they're always praying. But they're always praying with God there, kind of like he's supposed to keep handing me things. He's fix-it. He's the fix-it man. And if he doesn't fix it, I don't know about this. I know this works. And the reality is it doesn't work. The reality is it doesn't work. Because we're talking to the supreme creator, controller of everything, who also resides within us in a very personal way. We're talking about him as if he's some little kind of person who's like our servant. And he never becomes that. He never ever can. He cannot. He's the supreme. He cannot become little and under you, under your brain, under your heart. He does not become. But what he does do is he resides in the heart of everyone. And he tries to protect them as far as possible from the things of this world that they're attached to that are only going to cause them pain. He tries to protect them. Sometimes by allowing them to put their hand out and grab it. But he never becomes, somebody was saying to me recently, they were saying, Krishna arranged that my house was burgled. And then Krishna arranged that I got sick. And I was listening to them as they were describing the form of Krishna's mercy, and I was thinking, what a horrible God. I don't like this God. He says, I like you, Rasa, so I'm going to arrange to cut off your head. I was like, okay, it's great. You know, but Krishna doesn't arrange like that. He doesn't arrange like that. He's continuously arranging, trying to arrange for us in relationship to our free will, because we may want something that's going to lead us into danger. So he's arranging in ways to maybe protect us from that danger. Or he's arranging and waiting patiently for when we would turn to him and say, is there something more than this mental life I lead? Is there something more? And when we think like that, even for a moment, in the middle of cooking or cleaning or office work or anything, not in the puja, not when we're making the special effort, but anywhere, anytime, as soon as you think like that, instant reciprocation. Instant. But most of the time, we're passive. Okay, this, that. What have I got to do today? Here's my schedule. Got to get that done. Hare Krishna, Ram Ram. And we're not paying attention to him. We're paying attention to the outer world around us in a way that he remains also passive. Because he promises that your free will I will not interfere with, because you are a soul, you are a part of me, you are a person. So you must want me and I will want you. I want you, but you must want me before I can give myself to you. And what you're receiving from me, this is very indirect. This has very little actually to do with me. This is going on by way of my energies because you want that. But I don't give that. I give you love. I give you a relationship with me, because that is what you're looking for in every second of your sleeping and waking existence in this world. This is what you're really looking for. But you're looking for it in all sorts of different complex situations. And you may or you may not find it there. So the boys were with Krishna and they were complaining about how they had been humiliated by following his instructions. But they didn't have any loss of faith. Then Krishna, he heard them as they expressed all their frustration, and he laughed a little bit. And he told those boys in sweet words mixed with cleverness. Krishna said, "O boys, why are you affected so much by false anger? You should not have an antagonistic mood. You should not be like a newly married lady. Naturally, your minds are disturbed because selfish people always cause disturbance. The brahmanas were preoccupied and they could not attend to you. And then Krishna said to them, "Now, do you understand when I was glorifying the trees? The nature of the trees? Now that you can contrast them with the nature of the brahmanas, you can understand that these brahmanas do not possess the qualities of even the trees." So remember, Krishna said to them before, "One day you will understand the importance of my words," as he glorified the trees. So then he said to them, "These brahmanas, even if they have austerity and knowledge and dharma and everything else, they do not have any satisfaction if they're devoid of devotion. But I want you to go back again." Boys. And Krishna said, "On the other hand, in contrast to the brahmanas, the wives of these brahmanas are very, very exceptional. The wives of the brahmanas have so much devotion for me. So I want you to go back and this time go to the wives of the brahmanas and ask them for food." And Krishna said to them, "But don't tell them that Krishna is hungry. Because if you tell them that Krishna is hungry, they will be in so much anxiety. Because these ladies, they have great love and very, very soft hearts." So Krishna wanted to contrast to the boys and to us also the mood of the trees, the mood of the brahmanas. And then what he's going to do is he's going to show us the mood of the brahmanical ladies. Krishna told them that these wives' hearts are melted in affection by his attractive qualities and his skillful flute playing and his beautiful form, and by their tears. What he was going to explain to them was that these Brahmin ladies had a lot of exposure from their very youth to personalities who came from Vrindavan, because they were right on the edge. Mathura is here, Vrindavan is there. And one of the characteristics of these Brahmanas was that because they were so influential and qualified and expert, Kamsa had taken them into his service. So they were doing yagyas for him. So they had a position in society that was quite specific. And the Brahmin ladies, they had been hearing from the flower sellers who would come to bring the flowers to do the yagya. Some people would come with the kusha grass, some would come with the wood or the fruits or the flower, everything that needed to be there. They would come, and they were coming from Vrindavan. And so when they would come and the ladies would accept this service of supporting their husbands, they were hearing and hearing and hearing about Krishna. And they heard of how beautiful he was. And they heard of the gopis and how the gopis would dance with Krishna. And they would spend time with Krishna. And they heard of Mother Yasoda and how Krishna was so exquisite and his cheeks were so soft that you just touch like that. And they would change from a bluish hue to a pale pink color. They were like soft and soft, like a baby's skin. And they were hearing all these things, and they had been thinking and thinking of Krishna for a long time. And these wives understood that they may never, ever, ever meet Krishna. Because look at their husbands. Their husbands were so influential. They couldn't run away to visit Vrindavan, like we can run away from Melbourne and go to visit Vrindavan. They were very strictly placed in their homes and in their culture and in their duties. So they didn't have opportunity to do that. And so for a very long time they had been thinking how fortunate the residents of Vrindavan were. And they'd also been thinking that they were quite unfortunate because of their social responsibilities. So I want to stop our story here, because tomorrow we will hear about those ladies and what happened with them. And it's such a wonderful pastime. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, I was explaining this morning that in the Srimad Bhagavatam, this particular lila is encased within a very short chapter. And each one of those verses, just as this verse today, the boys are coming and they're calling the Brahmanas earthly gods, Bhumi Deva. And they're saying that Krishna and Balaram, they're very nearby. And please, acknowledge us. So this particular verse and each of the verses of the Bhagavatam, particularly the 10th canto, many different realized souls. A realized soul means somebody who has either come from the spiritual plane to do some mission of deliverance in this material world of those who are dark-eyed and covered, or it is somebody who has, by their own practice and their own devotion, their dedication to Guru and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and their service, they have become elevated and elevated to a point where, like in the Bhagavad Gita, Sanjay is speaking to Dhritarashtra and he's telling him what's taking place far, far, far away. Because he has, as Srila Prabhupada liked to sometimes say, his Mikey had a television in his heart. So Sanjay is watching this and he's describing it to the king. So in our Gaudiya Sampradaya, there are great personalities who are fully faithful to the Srimad Bhagavatam, who elucidate further on these different verses. And so when Srila Prabhupada was creating, in the very, very beginning in 1970, he had completed his Krishna book. And when Srila Prabhupada was traveling, he would travel with a volume in Bengali of many commentaries on each verse. And so then he would read through this and he would select at his own discretion what comments were suitable for this brand new Western frontier. Because the people he was speaking to, they didn't have any of the concepts in place. Just like I had a friend, and they said to me, because they were a computer whiz, and they said to me, I will show you how to use Photoshop. I said, oh, that would be very useful. And they started talking so quickly, and they said, first of all, you put the file in here, and then you do this, and then you do that. And I was just, my head was spinning. And I had to say to them, wait, slow down. I don't know what this is. I don't know what a file is. I don't know how to click on this. I don't know anything. And slowly, slowly, as I learned and practiced, even I didn't learn anything expertly, but I learned to do enough that I felt like, okay, I have some understanding. And so if somebody else came and started talking to me about that program, I knew what they were saying. But I can still remember my own confusion when I didn't know what any of the elements were of a computer. So similarly, Srila Prabhupada was going to a place where the people he was going to speak to knew none of the elements that he took fully for granted and had imbibed as his full pure consciousness. And so, if you listen to the early lectures of Srila Prabhupada in 1966, there's one very moving lecture where he's speaking to a group, and it was Srila Prabhupada would record his own lectures. There was no disciples, no devotees. He had a big tape recorder at that time with two reels. And before he would start chanting, he would record it because he knew the value of what he was doing. Nobody else knew the value. So he would put that recorder on and then he would speak. And at some point he said to his audience, and we cannot see them because there was no smartphones in those days, cannot see who he was speaking to, but he says to them, "Has any of you seen a picture of Krishna?" And he's talking away with full confidence about Krishna this and Bhagavad Gita this and so on. And he stops and asks this question. And then if you listen to his voice, he goes, "No? Oh." And he's not exactly disappointed, but it's sobering to think that none of the people there knew what, who, what, where. Krishna was Krishna. And he came to break that ignorance. So this is why, as you saw on the video, the YouTube videos that were released of that memorable 50th anniversary in Calcutta, how extraordinary that was, that somebody was leaving a place where everybody knew everything. Like here in the temple we talk to each other and they more or less know something about everything. And then going out to live amongst with a bag like this of oats. And they were thinking, well, if there's nothing else to eat, I'll just eat these. And he booked, when he arrived, he booked his ticket back after 2 months because he couldn't believe that anyone would be able to accept what he was going to bring to them. And he came. And he brought his message. And for a year, there was really not much response. He spoke to wealthy ladies in what's called Uptown New York, where the wealthy people live. And he spent some time in a small town in Pennsylvania called Butler. And he alerted a few people to his presence, but nobody really could grasp what he had in mind. And then he spoke to people in Uptown New York, then he moved from Uptown New York, he moved to the worst place. Everybody, anyone who's visited, I don't know what it's like now in New York, but in the 60s, 70s, anyone knew that the Bowery was where all the bums lived. And they live on the street, and you see they're sort of lying there on the street with some vomit beside them, and a plastic bag with an empty bottle in it. It's so crude. It's so crude. If it was to describe to you how crude it was, you'd all go, "Ooh, what did he?" And he went there. And he was staying with a young man who was smoking marijuana and taking LSD and eating meat. Now, would any of us like to do that? Mm-hmm. No, we would go, "That's a bit, just like the Brahmanas." We're a bit like the Brahmanas. But he didn't think twice. It was an opening. And he went there. And he was so extraordinary that he was trying to teach this David. He was trying to teach him Sanskrit. Sanskrit. And there's a wonderful interview in the Prabhupada Lilamrita where somebody from some hippie magazine comes, or newspaper, came to interview Srila Prabhupada. And they came upstairs and they came to this very big, it was a loft, which means the top of a very old warehouse building with a very high roof like this, and just plain walls, and the windows are up very high. It's not meant for living. And in those days people would rent these lofts because they could have music and do whatever they wanted up there. So he came in and he stood there for a while and he saw at the back there was a partition which had Indian bedspreads over it, which were quite popular as decorative items. And he saw that and he looked around and there were all these people, and young people, hippie people, long hair, drug addicted, and they were all sitting looking at the walls with their backs to their back to the room, and they're looking at the walls doing some kind of something. And he came in and he describes all this in his presentation, and he said, and then he looked at that, he saw this at the back, there was this partitioned area, and he came, looked at all these people who didn't talk to him or anything, came in and walked to the back and looked around, and behind that little partition he saw that Srila Prabhupada was sitting typing. And so then he introduced himself, and then he asked him, "What are they doing?" And Prabhupada said, "I don't know. I don't know, they're very confused." But then he explained to the man, "But I am very patient. I am very patient." So he was patient, and he was putting up with so much. And so he asks us to carry on his work. And it's difficult because we are not very patient. We are not very advanced. We are not very strong. We cannot go into an environment like that and be unaffected. We cannot 24 hours a day be fixed in our service to Krishna. But we can appreciate him. And that's a starting point. Because by appreciating somebody, their qualities rub off on you. That's why association, one has to be so careful, especially in the beginning, as one is beginning to grow a little bit in Krishna consciousness. One has to be careful, and it doesn't mean that you should be careful like you think everybody who's not able to accept Krishna consciousness has the plague. But one should just be a little careful what you take in, what you believe, what you accept. And it's a bit troublesome being careful. It's much more fun just to relax and let everything happen. But then everything will happen. Because we don't want everything to happen, we have to be a little bit careful. And gradually we get used to it. You get used to being a little bit careful. You begin to learn how to be very nice to people, but at the same time very careful. So you can talk to them, you talk, "Oh, that's very interesting, that's so nice," and so forth, but you don't take their ideas home and think, "Oh, I might try that." Because Srila Prabhupada explains, we have such a high level of Krishna consciousness from him, we don't need to be confused by taking in, "Did you hear about this, that, this new yoga teacher, this, you know, new way to do this, new way to do that, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da." And in our day and age, marketing is much more important than the quality of the product. This is one of the prime symptoms of Kali Yuga. So if you can talk big about yourself, you're so busy talking big about yourself, you have no time to practice your craft, because you've got to market yourself. So this is the modern world. So we don't want to get that all into us. We want to be somewhere sort of situated under Krishna's protection. So we deal with the world, but we deal with the world in relationship to his service. So thank you for your patient hearing, and if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer. Yes,
Mataji, these brahmanas have good association with these women. They are such high devotees, and they are feeding the Brahmins every day prasadam. So in spite of that, why they are so cruel and threatening?
Well, that's interesting. That's also explained that the Brahmanas, the Brahmin ladies, because they became attracted to hearing about Krishna, they became, how can you put it, they became less and less emotionally involved in their household affairs, because they were more and more thinking about Krishna and how they would love to meet him. So as their mind shifted towards Krishna, they became less and less, you could say, useful for their husbands. They performed all their duties. And there's a wonderful description of them which explains that their love for Krishna dictated to them proper and improper conduct. So they didn't neglect their husbands, but they didn't mentally, emotionally submit to their husbands as their earthly, as earthly gods. They did their service, but their hearts and minds were attracted to Krishna. So there's a little description that the Brahmanas saw that in their wives, that the wives were a little bit different, and they didn't like that. So they were a little bit not so keen on the wives. So they pushed the wives a little bit away. And the wives didn't mind that because they were fixed on thinking about Krishna. But because it's like, if I think that you're a little bit stupid, then if you tell me all kinds of things, I'll be thinking, like Brahma's thought of the boys, well, he's a little bit stupid, so I can't take anything he says very seriously. So in the same way they thought like that about their wives. They thought like that about the boys, and they also thought like that about their wives.
And we say that they are thinking Krishna like a paramour?
Some acharyas say they were thinking of Krishna as a paramour. Some of our acharyas say they were thinking of how Mother Yasoda was so fortunate because she got to feed Krishna. And so they were thinking of the elder gopis. So both accounts are given. According to the lila as it's perceived by that particular personality. Because you see, Krishna's lila is alive. It's not stereotyped like we read in the pages of a book. You can read this verse. If you were alive in Krishna consciousness, you could read the same verse every day for a year and something different would come from it. Because the Bhagavatam is alive, Krishna's alive. So some of them saw one way and some of them saw it. Krishna's reciprocating with each individual. Yes?
How not to become mechanical in service?
The first thing is, one time, I think it was my husband, he explained something to me. This is a material principle, but it's interesting. He said there's four stages in change. He said that the first one is you have to become what's called conscious incompetent. That means I suddenly become conscious that I'm incompetent. Before that I was unconscious incompetent. I was incompetent and I wasn't aware of it. And all of a sudden I've become conscious that I'm incompetent. That's a very important part. Because if you never become conscious that you're incompetent, you will never change. So after conscious incompetent, then one has to become conscious competent. That means that one now has to try to mechanically do it in another way. We've come from unconscious competent to conscious competent to conscious, sorry, unconscious incompetent to conscious incompetent, to conscious competent. And that's hard because you've got to keep remembering, oh yeah, I'm supposed to do it that way. It's like if some, I remember one day there was one lady and she was visiting me and she had her daughter with her and she kept telling her, stand up straight, stand up straight. And she was complaining to me, she stands so crooked, you know, no one will marry her. I was like, okay. So we kept saying, stand up straight, stand up straight. And the girl sort of didn't want, she was too young to think about anything like that. So she just sort of kept standing in the way she was standing. Stand up straight! And she's trying to stand up straight. Now, it was somebody else's consciousness was telling her to do that. She wasn't taking it up. So once she starts to think, oh yes I do, I should stand up straight. Then as she's standing up straight, but she's got to keep remembering. Because every time she forgets, she goes like that again. Oh, I've got to stand up straight. Forget. And mostly she'll forget, but she keeps remembering, oh, just stand up straight. So she keeps trying to stand up straight. So that's called conscious competence, because you have to remember to do it. And if you practice that for some time, if you're determined to practice that, then gradually it forms a new habit and it becomes unconscious competent, because now it happens by itself and you don't even notice it happening. But you've changed your habit from crooked to straight. And the problem is that most people get lazy and they just say this conscious competent is too much hard work. Let me go back to unconscious incompetence. But we as devotees don't want to do that. We want to become more and more qualified. You know, if you go outside and work in the world, as some people here do, but if you're working outside, even my daughter is an accountant, But they have to keep improving their skills. They have to pay a lot of money just to be registered. And you're paying them money just to be registered, but then they also demand, you know, pass this test, do this, do this, do this, because they want to keep you actively equally qualified and also moving forward in your career, not just sort of how you were 20 years ago and I'm an accountant. I have to be learning this, learning this. So that's a bit of bother for us as devotees, because we don't want to put all our attention towards our career. But if we don't put our attention towards our spiritual career, then what happens to us? We become lazy. We become spiritually lazy. Oh, it's too hard. I'm okay the way I am, and we're not okay the way we are. And that's why this pastime is so important. The trees are so generous, the brahmanas weren't generous, and the ladies are very generous. So we want to come to the place where our heart is very open to Krishna, that we want to serve him, and thereby will automatically, when that matures and ripens, we'll also want to serve others because they're part of him. Thank you. Very good question. Any other very good questions? Oh, yes.
Thanks, you know, the coward boy is telling to Krishna that how your words are putting confusion, because what you said, it didn't happen.
Yes.
We know that they're dealing with Krishna because they have a lot of trust.
Yes.
Right now they're dealing with devotees. And sometimes, you know, what they say may not happen. And that leads to, you know, relationship problems and how we have trust to devotees.
Well, it's interesting because it's certainly true that we're dealing with devotees, and devotees are on all different levels. And sometimes devotees may not be on the level where they're putting our interests first. But there's two points come to my mind. One is that Krishna was using those boys. His whole lila was to reciprocate with these ladies. But because those boys were so surrendered to him in love, they were willing to be used. They didn't mind being used. They were happy. If Krishna was happy, they were happy. So the highest state is when you think that, well, if Krishna's happy, I'm happy. And so maybe Krishna was telling them, he was misleading them when he told them go, they will be very receptive. They weren't receptive. So they even went back and said, you know, you said they would be nice, they weren't nice. And he just laughed. He didn't even say to them, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. So if we learn to trust Krishna, and that's the importance of the Bhagavatam class and all of our devotional practices, if we learn to trust Krishna, then when we're dealing with devotees, with their shortcomings and so forth, we won't confuse them with Krishna. And sometimes it's said that it's easier to surrender to Krishna than anybody else because he's perfect. But a conditioned soul thinks the opposite way. He's the most scary of all. He'll take away everything. I don't want him. So therefore, let me, I'll cooperate with this organization and get my needs met this way. But you see, in that state of mind, I'm thinking about what will come to me. I'm the central party, and this person told me to do such and such, or that person told me to do such and such, or that person misled me, or this. Everything's coming back to what I'm getting or not getting. And so I'm thinking, well, I think this formula or situation isn't quite the best for me. I'd do much better if I was somewhere else. Who for? For me. But these boys were the opposite. They're thinking for Krishna. So we have to learn to do that with or without the maximum kindness bestowed upon us by the devotees. So it's not that we ignore the devotees and only serve Krishna, but if you don't bring your Krishna consciousness to this final point, that the whole point of everything is Krishna's pleasure. I'm a servant of Krishna eternally. If you don't bring that into your formula of thinking, you'll always be wrong. whether you do it or don't do it, you'll always be a little bit wrong, incorrect. Why? Because you'll have a selfish motive that I want this, I need this, I want this, this has done this to me, and so forth. And that's all of our situations, actually, to greater or lesser degrees. And so to greater or lesser degrees, we have this learning again, oh, I've got to look at that, put my attention there. And a very competent person, they don't withdraw their attention from there. They're so skilled in their bhakti that they keep their attention there, and things go on here, but they keep their attention there. So we'll hear of that through these wonderful ladies. Yes. Did you?
It's an interesting observation of Krishna when he compared the Brahman's consciousness to that of the merit. The consciousness of the Brahmins is a newly married wife.
Yeah, like a newly married. Don't know. No, he didn't. He said the boys shouldn't be like a newly married wife because they were arguing. He said you shouldn't argue like a newly married wife. Shri Jiva Goswami makes that comment. Yes, because they're saying nah, 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 nah. So because they're criticizing to Balaram. There's so much life and vitality in Krishna's pastimes, and when you get into the habit of finding your life and vitality there, then this world becomes really sort of like sawdust in comparison, because you begin to see, not in a critical nasty way, but you begin to see that all living entities in the material world, because they're conditioned souls, they're blind, they have their blinkers on, they can't see what's really happening, and they're self-centered. And this is their disease. And Srila Prabhupada never became angry with that. He didn't judge them and sort of push them away, how disgusting. Instead, he saw, of course, this is their disease. And I've come here as a doctor, so a doctor can't say, oh my gosh, you're sick! Help! The doctor's there, right? Doctor can't become upset because the patient is sick. So as devotees, we should know that. We should know that we're also aspiring to become advanced, and we also have some sickness as well. Sometimes we need good expert advice on what to do with the relationship between our impediments and the circumstances that we're in. But I always encourage people to first of all try and come in here and take shelter, learn how to take shelter, learn how to take shelter of the deities. And in that regard, Srila Prabhupada explained that there's two types of prayers that you can offer. And one type of prayer, in one sense, is more valid than the other. Of course, the type of prayer that comes naturally to us is kind of help, 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 help. I'm having a really bad day today, please help me. I don't know how to cope with this and something. That's a personal prayer, and that's valid. But if you want to elevate your personal prayers up to a real sense of relationship with the deities, you have to learn the prayers of liberated souls and learn to pray like that. And therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he wrote so many song books. We have some of his songs, his bhajans, in our Gaudiya Vaishnava song book, but there's so many more that are available. And in those, he expresses his own unworthiness, he expresses his own fears, he expresses everything, but he expresses it with appropriateness. In other words, he glorifies and then expresses. So if we memorize them, those prayers, or the prayers from the Bhagavatam, and we learn to say them, it elevates us up to a much more suitable way of approaching. And there's so many nice prayers. I was reading in Govardhan last year, where the wives of the Kaliya, the wives of Kaliya and the Yajna Brahmanas are linked in our Jai Radhe, Jai Krishna, Jai Vrindavan. We glorify them, Jai, we say Jai to them both. But the wives of Kaliya, they offered very Vedic prayers to Krishna, because, but behind it they were very frightened that their husband might be going to be destroyed at this point, although they had bhakti for Krishna. And why were they trying to protect their husband? Because they discovered that he was now becoming a Vaishnava. So they then stepped forward and offered their prayers. But poor old Kaliya, he was a bit of a rascal, and he was all troubled by Krishna, so he was kind of lying there lifeless, having had all the poison in him danced out of him. Danced out of him. Not crushed out of him, but danced out of him. But he was just on the verge of death, and all the poison, everything, and as the poison from his mind, from his body was being removed, he began to recognize who Krishna was. But he couldn't get his prayers together very quickly because it was a little bit under duress. So he offers a little version of his wife's prayers. But he says in there, it's so nice, he says, you know, I'm a snake. You know, snakes are born envious. What can I do? You make snakes. So he offers this prayer, but he offers something that we can relate to. Because we sometimes feel, I'm a this, what can you, you know, you made me. I mean, it's, we like to say, it's your fault. But, and in part, we can say that as long as we understand that it's not really your fault. It's actually my fault, but you made me. So we can be honest in our praying. That's the point. To learn from them how to become honest, but to pray in a way that's pleasing to Krishna. Alright, thank you. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.